Why is American government so ineffective? The answer can't be determined by starting with today's obvious dysfunction, the partisan squabbling, the empty posturing, the almost complete inability to take action on serious social problems, and trying to figure out who or what is responsible for them. Nothing we can currently observe is really to blame in any fundamental sense. These things are symptoms, not causes, according to our next guest. In the new book, Relic, How Our Constitution Undermines Effective Government and Why We Need a More Powerful Presidency, scholars William Howe and Terry Moe argue that the causes have been there for ages, rooted in the Constitution. Again, the name of the new book is Relic, and we welcome William Howe to the roundtable. He is the Sidney Stein Professor in American Politics at the University of Chicago, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
William Howe is the Sidney Stein Professor in American Politics at the University of Chicago. What got you thinking about this particular subject?
My co-author, Terry Moe, and I have been writing on and thinking on the American presidency for a long time. We've been thinking also about the sort of the status of the Constitution and the ways in which the Constitution builds impediments for the government to solve problems. And we wanted to collect our thoughts on the matter. And the result is this book that's before you.
When it comes to the Constitution and undermining effective government, that subtitle indicates that these problems have been with us for a very long time, since the inception.
That's correct. There is a widespread recognition that there's pervasive dysfunction in our contemporary politics. And there are lots of reasons for that, having to do with the polarized parties, money in politics, and the like. And we want to suggest that those forces certainly make matters worse, but you can trace back the kind of impediments to problem solving all the way back to the Constitution. That, in fact, our Constitution creates a system of government that doesn't make problem solving easy, and it wasn't built to fashion institutions that were intended to solve the kinds of problems that we face in modern times. And that disjuncture, that break between what our government is capable of doing and what we demand of it, warrants sustained attention and scrutiny, we think.
You write a lot in the book about change and social and economic changes that have taken place, certainly during the late 1800s and early 1900s. So what exactly spawned all of this to get us to the point where we are now in such an exacerbated sense of what happened to bring us to where we are right now?
Well, the problems that we have now, we want to suggest, are born of lots of factors having to do with the changing status of America on the world stage, changes in technology, macroeconomic changes. There are many, many sources of the various problems and challenges that we as a country face. The basic problem is that we have inherited a set of governing institutions that were fashioned some 225 years ago at a time when there were fewer than 4 million people stateside, 700,000 of whom included slaves, 3.2 million non-slaves, the vast, vast majority of whom could not even vote. So this was a time of a very small country that was consisted overwhelmingly of farmers in an isolated neck of the world community. And it was designed to build a government that was meant to check the tyranny of the majority, to limit power, to fragment power, and not meant to play anything like the kind of role that our government plays in contemporary political life. And so the problem is one that we see this rapid and awe-inspiring changes to our economy, to our society, to the technologies that we use that have unearthed all kinds of problems, and we don't have a set of governing institutions that are fit for the challenge. Now, it's worth noting, this basic problem was recognized some 120 years ago by the progressives. They, too, lamented the inability of our governing institutions to meet the challenges then of the industrialization of the economy, the rise of the United States onto the world stage, large-scale immigration, these kinds of things. And they sought to adapt our institutions and to break through, as they put it, break through the constitutional form. The problem is that their handiwork only took us so far, and that the problems have have exacerbated over the last century, and we failed to keep up. And the basic architecture of our governing institutions that we inherited from the Constitution remain in place. And so we're looking for some kind of a corrective to that.
We'll get to the corrective in a moment. I am interested, though, in there were times in the not-so-distant past that there was bipartisan discussion and people were working together to solve problems. That has vanished. So does that not take care of a certain step of this, of just a willingness to work together on a problem within the system that, yes, was created 225 years ago?
Yeah, so polarization, and we've seen rising polarization over the last 40 or so years, has exacerbated the problem. There's no doubt about that. But the core problem, as we see it, is that we have, as our first branch of government, an institution that is deeply parochial in its orientation, that pays attention to short-term concerns at the expense of long-term concerns, and that has profound incentives to pay attention to the pieces rather than think about how do we fashion governing institutions, agencies, and laws that have a coherency and integrity for the whole. And those facts emerge from the basic design of Congress. The parochialism emerges from the fact that members are elected from districts and states, and they see policy first and foremost through the lens of how that policy is going to affect their district or state, not how it's going to affect the country as a whole. They're worried about the election every 2 years in the House, which fixates their attention on short-term considerations, sometimes at the expense of longer-term considerations. And precisely because it's a collective decision-making body, the Congress has powerful incentives, each member one at a time, to pay attention to the small pieces that affect their constituents back home and pay less attention to how the pieces add up into a coherent whole. These are all facts that have been true about Congress ever since its inception. So to say it is true, I mean, you're right to point out there were times when we saw greater collaboration across the parties, but the fact that we don't see it layers the problem of party polarization onto a governing institution that is deeply dysfunctional when it comes to addressing modern problems. But it doesn't, if you take away the polarized parties, it's not that then you have, we then will sort of suddenly magically have a Congress that's capable of attending to the challenges of things like climate change, comprehensive immigration reform, addressing the problems of rising wealth inequality and income inequality, deep and pervasive poverty in urban settings in particular. These are the kinds of problems that we see our federal government and Congress in particular is being ill-equipped to address, and that we want to sort of move towards in a direction that allow us to get some handle on.
So your fix for this, the proposal in the book, is a constitutional amendment. Tell us what that would include and what it would ultimately fix.
So we want to encourage people to first pay attention to the need for institutional reform. If we want to get serious about fashioning policies that are going to meet the challenges of our day, we have to come to terms with the fact that our political institutions are in need of reform. And we want to shift attention away from Congress and towards the presidency. The reason we want to do that is because the president and the president alone has a national constituency, that presidents' concerns about legacy encourage presidents to pay attention to the longer time horizon. And precisely because presidents sit alone atop their governing institution, they care deeply about the integrity and the coherence of the policies that they advance. So on each of the deficits that we see for Congress, we see upside on the presidency. Now, this is not a call for a generically more powerful presidency. We're not saying that anything that gives more power to the president is to the good, nor are we calling for important checks to be eradicated from our system of separated powers. Rather, what we want to call for is to enhance the president's agenda-setting power. And what that means is to give something akin to permanent and universal fast-track authority to the president, where in the president would have the power to make legislative proposals that then Congress would be forced to vote on an up or down basis within a set period of time. Now, they would be free to vote against this bill, any bill that the president puts forward, but they would have to vote. They would have to move forward. And so what we're calling for is, rather than having the president sit at the back seat of government, put him, move him up to the front seat, make him an agenda setter, but certainly keep and maintain legislative and judicial checks on executive authority.
So what power would Congress lose in this if they're being put in the back seat?
Well, what they could no longer do is simply ignore the president when the president calls for policy change. They could no longer fill presidential proposals with add-ons and qualifications and loopholes. They would have to meet the president on the president's term and vote for or against the proposals that he puts forward. They would be free, though, to carry on to propose legislative proposals as they currently do now. So what we're talking really about is an enhancement of executive agenda setting authority, but we're not talking about shutting down Congress in any way. We're simply allowing the president to propose things, which formally he can't do now, and to force a congressional response, right? So right now, the president has fast-track authority on trade policy, but that's depends upon Congress's willingness to delegate it. And so last year, they reinstated fast-track authority to Obama, to the president. This would simply make that power permanent and would not limit it to trade policy. We would include it on all legislation and all appointments.
So let's do a scenario. So the president wakes up to find out that a Supreme Court justice has passed away. After a few weeks, he names someone to fill that position. And then, as we see it now, no deal. It's been shut down. Would this change that?
This would change that. This would allow the president to say, my nominee is Merrick Garland, and you need to now deliberate on whether or not you want to improve this nominee. And they would be free to vote him down as they under our preferred governing arrangement, as they currently are free to do so now. But what they can't do is simply ignore it. This isn't going to suddenly unleash all matter of legislative activity. There are going to be some policies that will continue to be stuck on because there will be meaningful disagreement across the various branches of government. But on some, such as comprehensive immigration reform, we might see a way forward. So several years ago, rather famously, Obama came out and said, look, if I could just get a vote in the House on this bill, this comprehensive immigration reform bill, it would pass because there is the majoritarian support needed in order to pass it. He simply couldn't get the bill because Boehner, the majority leader at the time, refused to bring it forward. By giving the president this power, he can ensure, one, that he would get the vote, and two, it would be a vote on the bill as he, someday she, puts forward, not sort of a rough, faint facsimile thereof.
Is this the election year for you to float a proposal for more presidential power?
Because of all of the madness in the Republican and Democratic parties.
How much power do you want to give these people?
That's right. So we have thought long and hard about this. And the argument that we're putting forward is an institutional argument. It's recognition that there are problems built into the fabric of Congress that impede the federal government's ability to address big, hard problems. And these problems are getting bigger and bigger. The debt's growing. The sea waters are rising. And inequality is becoming more and more exacerbated. Now, the concern is, right, well, why would you want to give enhanced powers to a madman, right? Why would you ever want to do that?
Yeah.
Let me say a couple of things. The first is it's really problematic to reason institutionally from either fondness or fear from any individual who might inhabit an office. It's what we need to do is think about how you design institutions that create incentives for political actors to behave in ways that are abide the public interest and the public will. Now there may be instances where people are going to run for office and attract a lot of attention that we we might think are really problematic. And it's in this way that, you know, we have a democracy and the will of the people will be expressed. And we could certainly fashion a system of governments that keeps anybody from holding office, from actually being able to do anything. And it actually wouldn't look especially different from the government that we have, right? It's one in which power is separated and fragmented, and a collective decision-making body that's riddled with dysfunction is put at the helm. And what we have as a result of these institutions is a situation in which we can't get any traction on solving climate change or rising inequality or immigration reform in any comprehensive, meaningful sense. So it is true that the objection to the kind of claim that we're making is can be expressed in one word, right? Trump, right? And then we'll think, oh, goodness, no, no. To which I think we would say is what we're trying to do is reason institutionally. And the truth of the matter is that for this current election, what we're most likely to see is a President Clinton, Hillary Clinton holding office. That's most likely how all this is going to play out. And what we're observing now exceptionally is deep divisions within the Republican Party that are being worked out in a very public fashion.
Well, the name of the book is Relic: How Our Constitution Undermines Effective Government and Why We Need a More Powerful Presidency. The book is published by Basic Books. Terry Moe and William Howe are the authors. William Howe, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Relic: How Our Constitution Undermines Effective Government and Why We Need a More Powerful Presidency. The book is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.